VOA, the science edition of Press Conference USA. Here's your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Welcome to the science edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Space history was made in early February when aerospace giant Space Exploration Technologies Corporation, or as most people know it, SpaceX, launched the world's first sports car into space. The car even had a passenger going along for the ride, a mannequin called Starman. Social media exploded with videos of Starman decked out in a SpaceX spacesuit, seemingly driving the car through the darkness of outer space. The sports car was used as the payload for a test launch of what some consider to be the world's most powerful rocket, the SpaceX Heavy Falcon. The successful test launch of the rocket that could someday send a manned spacecraft to Mars or to an asteroid in deep space illustrated the potential and many possibilities of private sector space industries in the future of space exploration. Until the last decade or so, space travel was the exclusive domain of government-run space agencies such as NASA in the U.S., Russia's Roscosmos, and the European Space Agency. But in the era of shrinking government budgets, breakthroughs in technology, and a strong entrepreneurial spirit worldwide, private space industries such as SpaceX, Orbital ATK, and Arianespace are filling and are expected to fill a void once dominated by the big government space agencies. Since the U.S. Space Shuttle program ended in 2011, NASA has had a deal with Roscosmos to send American astronauts to the International Space Station, or ISS. NASA has also contracted with aerospace companies SpaceX and Orbital ATK to regularly send supplies to and from the ISS. And according to the Washington Post, the Donald Trump administration would like to end direct government support of the ISS in 2024 and hand over U.S. operations of the space station to a private venture. So on today's Science Edition of Press Conference USA, we'll talk about the past, present, and future of corporate involvement in space travel and exploration. My guest for today's program is Casey Dreyer, the Director of Space Policy at the Planetary Society, which is headquartered in Pasadena, California. It's a private nonprofit organization whose mission is to empower citizens of the world to advance space science and exploration. Casey Dreyer joins us today by telephone. Casey, I understand that early space research and exploration was the result of military efforts. So can you give us a little background on how and why the military initially got involved with this back in the 1940s and 50s?
Well, I would say it even predates that. When you think about it, the first real rockets were invested in the military back in World War I. As missiles, right? Now you had this very early contribution from military interest in terms of changing the fundamental tactics on the battlefield. And then after World War I, you started seeing some sorts of investment, particularly in Germany, in developing new weapons that wouldn't necessarily pique the interest of the other European powers. And so rocketry was one of those areas that was certainly invested in as forward-thinking battlefield, you know, changing technology. That really upped its game in the 1940s during World War II, and that's where you saw significant investment, particularly again in Germany, with the V-2 rocket with Wernher von Braun and his team in creating these weapons that would hit London. They called them the vengeance weapons too, the V-2. And then people began to realize that you had much broader implications. And though, of course, people like Wernher von Braun from the very beginning really had designs and intentions to go beyond using just these things for rockets and weapons of death to sending people to the moon and sending people deeper into space. And, you know, rockets, again, are just missiles that just don't land on other people and hurt them. So it's the shared technology has always been kind of this genus, a two-faced capability. And space from the very beginning has had to grapple with this weaponization of its capability with the greater, more positive ambitions of sending people and scientific instruments deeper into space.
Well, we still have to admit that the military and outer space still has a pretty strong link together after all these years.
Oh, absolutely it does. And you can look in the United States, for example, you can really think that there are two space programs in the United States. One is NASA, And then the other one is kind of the purely robotic or uncrewed, unmanned space program run by military assets. And that's kind of a, you know, spy satellites, communication satellites, battlefield viability, and other kind of missile launch detection satellites. And the budget actually for all of the military space activities in the United States is significantly larger than NASA, the civilian space program. And the shared contractor base, the companies that actually provide a lot of the engineering services and design and capability, will work both for military and for NASA at the same time. And so the combination of the two really keeps the industrial workforce engaged here. And so, yes, absolutely, there's a connection. Though I would emphasize at a higher level, what NASA does in particular is very distinct and separate in terms of what they do. No NASA money funds military applications of weapons, and generally it's the same from the military side to NASA. There's a split between military and civilian space policy in the United States.
At least here in the United States, space, launching rockets, etc., was mostly the domain of science fiction, but it wasn't until 1958 when the USSR launched Sputnik. After Sputnik, everything changed.
That's absolutely true. And there was a surprising, actually caught the President Eisenhower by surprise, the public backlash and almost fear in a certain sense to the access of space first by the Soviet Union in terms of the Cold War. And the idea wasn't new. You had a U.S. studies from the Rand Corporation from 1946 about a world-circling satellite, and people saw the clear connection between the capabilities of the V-2 rocket to just being able to go higher up into space and put something there first. And they just didn't see the true importance of it. They didn't have that vision for it. And so when the Soviets finally did it with Sputnik, the idea that the United States had lost the so-called high ground in space, or also just lost the technological capability demonstration if you're competing for the hearts and minds, so to speak, of countries around the world, suddenly the Soviet system appeared to leapfrog beyond what the United States was capable of. And that really turbocharged the United States' political motivation to invest in space technology. And you saw the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA, established just less than a year after Sputnik launched. Mm-hmm. And you had the United States began investing in its own satellite technology then.
Wasn't NASA designed or thought of as a civilian space program rather than the military program?
It absolutely was, and it still is. And that was a very conscious choice, actually, made by Eisenhower at the time. But again, you can think of this as, even though it was a civilian program, the idea that the United States suddenly spend many, many billions of dollars or something have to align with some sort of national priorities. It wasn't expressly military, and there was nothing aggressive or posturing about it. It stood for something. It was a symbol of capability, right? It was a symbol of your technological ability, your scientific ability, and also your the power of your industrial and workforce in your country to be able to put something incredibly complex and expensive together. The idea that this was a signaling intent, that the United States and the Soviet Union were signaling to each other and to the rest of the world the strength of their, basically the nation, as a proxy for warfare. So instead of going to war with each other, you could have a space race.
And then, of course, the United States successfully sent man into space, and that sort of encouraged President Kennedy to issue his challenge of landing a man on the moon and returning safely back to Earth before the end of the 1960s. What impact did that have?
Well, we should just clarify, the first man in space was Yuri Gagarin, a Soviet cosmonaut. And when Kennedy gave his first moon speech, they hadn't even launched John Glenn to orbit the Earth yet, mm-hmm. So they were feeling behind in the space race, and they actually had to challenge the administrator of NASA at the time. Kennedy was asking, what goal can we set ourselves to completely, you know, win this race or demonstrate our superiority? What is possible to beat the Soviets in at this perceived time of falling behind? And they went through a couple iterations, and they decided on landing on the moon, and they thought it was just on the edge of their capability to do it. And again, when you think about the fact that they hadn't even launched an astronaut into orbit around the Earth, they declared the intent to land on the moon within the next 10 years. It's really an astonishing claim. Mm-hmm. They really put themselves out there, and that's why you saw, again, that demonstrates the alignment of the ambition with the political ability to marshal the type of resources and money needed to achieve that goal, because it became basically one of the highest priority goals in government based on how much money they threw at it.
along with the development of the space agency NASA and its different goals, their budget peaked in 1966. But in fiscal year 2017, NASA's budget now stands at the lowest percentage of the federal budget in NASA history. How did this drop in funding impact NASA's work?
Well, you can see the fact that we're no longer sending people to the moon. We're not sending people any further beyond the moon. We've been in low Earth orbit, basically just orbiting around the Earth for the last 40 years since the end of Apollo program. That's one of the biggest impacts of that. And then also NASA is kind of struggling to maintain an aging infrastructure that was built for Apollo that they can't really get rid of due to political constraints. And they're kind of burdened with this. I think they may be the 10th largest owner of just property in space in the United States in terms of federal agencies. They just have huge footprint. The fact that you've seen a much more limited human spaceflight program, a much less ambitious human spaceflight program, is a true consequence of that. And then also, there are so many things we could be doing in space, not just for sending people into space, but also the scientific discovery, searching for life, establishing, you know, new ways of doing business or encouraging more people to go, that just can't happen because of that limited set of resources. And not only was NASA 4% of overall government spending, but of the pot of money, it's called discretionary. Basically, the funds that Congress actually has oversight of every single year, as opposed to broad spending on mandatory programs, service on the national debt, and so forth, that are written into law and automatically spent. NASA peaked at something like 20% of that annual discretionary spending. In that context, it's down to something like 4% now. So it's definitely shrunk. I mean, the percentage of just in terms of absolute buying power, it's something like half to a third of what it was able to do back in the Apollo program. Remember, NASA was almost singularly focused on Apollo. NASA just has a much more limited pot of money, and it's much more spread around than it was in the 1960s as well.
I was surprised to read, Casey, that private and non-government involvement with the space program began a lot earlier than many of us might think, going back to 1962 with Telstar and onward with private satellites being launched. Now, who were among the first companies to be involved with space technology, and what were some of their accomplishments?
From a very early point, NASA in its very early days decided to not do too much in-house, in the sense that they wanted to work with private industry as contractors to begin with. And so you saw Rocketdyne, Martin Marietta, Grumman, all of these early aerospace companies were used as contractors. And these are with NASA kind of setting the expectations, the private industry doing the actual work with oversight of NASA. And that was a conscious decision to pursue that sort of arrangement, actually in order to help establish political support for the space program back in the early 60s. And so in addition to these more commercial marketplaces, the idea that you would have these communication satellites was an early thing. They had test demonstrations for being able to beam, you know, educational programming to developing countries around the world. And then you also had this intent to use the space shuttle, particularly it was when the real big movement was happening in the early 1980s, to service and launch commercial platforms into space. All that kind of early intent basically ended in the 1980s with the Challenger disaster. And so the idea that privatization or commercialization is new, as you said, is somewhat incorrect. From the very beginning, NASA has engaged with the commercial sector. And what is changing now is kind of the formal structure of that relationship is changing. And the companies themselves are starting to develop their own ambitions beyond just serving government.
Up until 1984, U.S. law had stated that only NASA could launch space vehicles in the U.S. But in 84, the U.S. Commercial Space Launch Act was signed by then-President Reagan, which allowed private companies to conduct their own launches. And the U.S. Office of Commercial Space Transportation was formed, which today is being run by the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration. Tell us about the impact about the Commercial Space Launch Act.
Well, as I said, that was kind of the idea that the government get out of controlling the entire access to space and the entire market. The government had gone all in on the space shuttle to say that it should be the only launch vehicle for the entire needs of the U.S. government and the commercial sector. The space shuttle was originally anticipated to fly something like 25 to 35 times per year. I think it peaked at eight or nine flights in a year. So it never got close to flying as often. And as a consequence of that, you started getting these bottlenecks of being able to launch into space. And so part of that act was to help open up the ability for particularly even the military to contract with other companies to develop launch systems to be able to access space. And also, again, the motivations are very similar. And you can see the politics of Reagan. You can see it in the current administration now. And the idea of privatizing parts of government was just an ideologically powerful motivation. And so why not apply that to space? And again, you started to see some consequences from that, again, before the Challenger disaster. You started seeing some commercial platforms being developed for the space shuttle. Orbital, the company, was founded around that era to advance an agenda into their space exploration and using the shuttle as a platform. And you had this kind of initial burst of activity that, again, was pretty much snuffed out with the Challenger disaster, because suddenly what was seen as a routine access to space and a promising future platform became astronauts being asked to sacrifice their lives, and to what end? Are we sending people into space to possibly die to service a communication satellite? Is that worth the risk of human life, or should we have greater ambitions than that? And that ended that early experiment.
You're listening to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. This is Rick Pantaleo reminding you that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow and connect with us on Twitter or Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. And you can also send us an email to PCUSA@voanews.com. Let's return to today's program. Today, we're talking about the private sector's growing involvement in space travel and exploration. My guest for today's program is Casey Dreyer, the Director of Space Policy at the Planetary Society, which is headquartered in Pasadena, California. It's a private nonprofit organization whose mission is to empower citizens of the world to advance space science and exploration. Casey, the 1980s seemed to be a time when the private sector's desire to play a more active role in space travel and exploration began to really take off.
The issue has always been, fundamentally, is what market are you trying to serve? And can you compete in that worldwide launch market? And, you know, it's not just enough to say that you're a private company, that you can create a service. There has to be a demand and a customer to sustain you beyond, ideally, government. And I think that's always been the long-term struggle of these private companies as they try to develop access into space.
In 1990, Casey, a new law called the Launch Services Purchase Act ordered NASA to pay private companies to launch their payloads when possible. So we started to see the uptick into private-public interaction regarding space exploration.
Yeah, and you saw that really in the 90s, and this wasn't just NASA ultimately, but also the needs of military launches, which is really the true market for launch in the United States, is the military launch market. And you saw the continuation of the Delta and Atlas rocket lines that were actually being designed with input from the military, from NASA, but also with the idea that they would compete on the national launch market for what was seen as this inevitable growth of communication satellites. And those were being designed by Lockheed and Boeing, ultimately Lockheed Martin and Boeing, and they struggled ultimately to find a market after the economic downturn in the early 2000s. And again, this goes back to what is a private company. NASA had always worked with private companies, and it's in a sense the relationship between the two that you're starting to see this shift. How much oversight should NASA or another government agency have into the detailed operations or specifications of rocket and other means of accessing space versus kind of stepping back and then putting, in a sense, more trust in the company to deliver on your needs without a detailed oversight and design parameters based on them, and also giving them leeway to operate more broadly. And that, I think, again, what we're seeing here is this overall historical trend of NASA, basically, and other government agencies learning to step back from the industry itself to allow it to pursue its own needs.
We've often heard about something called space tourism. I understand Richard Branson has Virgin Galactic. What do you see as the future for space tourism? Do you see people hopping aboard a rocket ship anytime soon?
I guess it depends what you mean by soon. You know, I'm always mixed on this. I think at some level it's inevitable. And the trick is, though, is that initially it's going to be very expensive. And you're going to need essentially wealthy people to buy tickets. But at the same time, wealthy people don't want to die. You know, most people don't want to die. And so you have to develop or give some sort of confidence, high amounts of confidence, that your $250,000 ticket into, you know, maybe just going into space for a few minutes is not going to kill you. And you've seen, again, the fact that space is one of the harshest environments. That humans are not evolved to live in space. Really, space is just trying to kill you all the time. Radiation, incredible temperature swings you're going through, the thermal environments that you're in, trying to have to control the temperature inside. You have to breathe. Basically, you bring a little bubble of Earth with you into space. That's hard to do because space does not like anything but a vacuum. And the efforts by Virgin Galactic, and I would also add Blue Origin to this as well. That's one of their ambitions, is to have suborbital space tourism, is trying to have these incredibly reliable space vehicles that they can at least somehow have a market with. And you're seeing Virgin Galactic struggle with that. The company that they're working with, they had their first test flight, I think, back in 2004 with their space plane. And then we have seen no access into space since. And they've had an accident. They lost two test pilots a few years ago. And the date at which they want to go into space for their first test keeps slipping into the future. I think it just underlines the incredible difficulty of creating a reliable platform to send people into space. It's not impossible, but at some level, absent incredibly breakthrough technology in terms of reliability, and I think perhaps SpaceX super heavy lift vehicle, BFG, the big Falcon rockets, or VFR, that would able to do point-to-point landings from one spot in the Earth to another. You get basically this free suborbital flight. You get a little bit of weightlessness between the two stops. That actually may be a larger driver of people accessing space than just going up and coming back down on a pleasure cruise. If you get to go into space and you get to go to your meeting in Shanghai in an hour and then come back and have dinner with your family that same night, that actually may be a stronger driver for a market need than pure pleasure travel.
Let's talk about a couple of the corporations here in the United States, at least, that are main drivers of the private-public space consortium. Orbital Sciences Corporation was formed back in the 90s. How are they involved with NASA and the space program?
Orbital provides a independent launch capability to send cargo to the International Space Station, and they received funding from NASA to help develop this rocket, I believe is the Antares rocket, and they send cargo, and they don't really have much plans beyond it seems like, but they're one of the ways at which the space station receives its services that it needs. And it was funded over a series of milestones throughout the 2000s and beyond to say that we're developing a rocket on our own. They had to put up significant capital and venture capital of their own to match the funding that NASA was giving them. And they ultimately, you know, it's a pretty successful rocket. It has exploded once. They had to change the engines that they were using, old Soviet launch engines. Now they use a different type of Russian engine. It hasn't really broken into a much larger market beyond what it serves with the space station. So it hasn't changed the market the way that some of the other companies have. But they're a long-term player, and they definitely began with this ambition to participate in do aerospace in a different kind of way.
The space company that gains most of the attention these days is Space Exploration Technologies, known mostly as SpaceX, headed by Elon Musk, and it was founded in 2002. Tell us about the role that SpaceX is contributing to the privatization of space exploration.
It's hard to underestimate how much SpaceX has changed the conversation and overall structure of particularly the launch market, the rocket market in the world. SpaceX was dismissed by many people when it first began. It survived many near-death experiences as a company, almost running out of money multiple times. This is an incredible story. And what they basically did was prove everybody wrong in terms of what an affordable rocket could look like and in terms of its reliability. And they continue to prove people wrong with the development of the Falcon Heavy, which is a heavy lift launch vehicle that can throw more weight into space than the smaller ones. And it was completely developed with private money, the Heavy was. They had the same kind of process that Orbital had developing their Antares rocket with the Falcon 9. NASA kicked in half the money, SpaceX kicked in the other half, and so they both had skin in the game to try to make this rocket work. Basically, they have the advantage of creating a rocket company from the ground up with modern technology. A lot of legacy aerospace contractors have been established and have their internal hierarchies and internal structures and their physical locations and structures and the relationships with the government established for decades, if not half a century or more. SpaceX was able to start from scratch and say, how do we build a rocket that is as affordable as possible, minimizes all the production complications, and can scale to the future with our own ambitions? And that's a key thing, too. This is a truly private company, SpaceX. SpaceX is not publicly traded. Elon Musk is essentially the benevolent dictator of this company. And as such, he can have it do whatever they want to do with their own money. They don't have to answer to shareholders, right? So they can say, instead of making a big profit, I'll plow all of my revenues into developing of a heavy lift rocket like the Falcon Heavy. No one told us to do that, but I personally want to go to Mars as Elon Musk, so I will need a heavy lift rocket. So let's do that. And then they're able to do it. And that's a huge shift in terms of attitude about what a private company does. It no longer exists to serve the needs of government, which can change and do change over presidential administrations and different congresses. This is a single visionary who's able to keep a persistent focus over long periods of time. That's a unique aspect of it. And then the other aspect of it is that they have been wildly successful doing what they said they were going to do. They're always late. They never do it on time, but they tend to ultimately pull off what they say they're going to do. So the fact that the Falcon 9 is roughly half the cost of a comparable rocket that was extant already in the United States or even around the world has fundamentally changed the entire rocket business. You have, not just in the United States, you have the United Launch Alliance, which is the competitor to SpaceX and generally serves government launch needs. They are ending both of their rockets in the next 10 years and building a new lower-cost rocket explicitly to compete with SpaceX. You have the international launch market, particularly in Europe, the Ariane rocket family, redesigning itself explicitly to compete with the lower cost of the Falcon 9. And for the first time in over a decade, the United States, via SpaceX, competes for commercial satellite communications launches because they can match price of all these other international launch capabilities with China, with India, with Russia, and have a reliable launch service. So it's hard to understate, again, the importance of SpaceX in disrupting what was essentially a moribund industry of launch services worldwide.
You answered half of my final question, Casey, regarding SpaceX. You mentioned about Elon Musk's pride and determination. Well, how else do private industry benefit from spending all this money on space programs and space equipment, especially since it's so expensive?
You know, that's kind of yet to be determined. We're in this interesting point here, honestly, in terms of a private space exploration or the private market with space exploration. Because as you said, space is still really hard and it's very difficult. A SpaceX Falcon 9 is quote unquote affordable, but you know, you or I would have to still shell out something like $60 to $70 million for a single launch, and that's with a reusable rocket. These are not cheap still. And so you still need immense amount of private capital to pursue things in space. And honestly, what we're seeing here is the primary customer. No matter if you're an old school aerospace contractor or if you're a new private space company, your main source of revenue is going to be from government contracts. And what NASA very smartly decided to do back in the mid-2000s was purposely help invest government money to try to make space companies that can stand on their own 2 feet. So getting over that initial hump of investment, basically, that's what NASA was trying to do. And they've been very successful in helping SpaceX and some other companies do that. But at the same time, we're in this period where we don't exactly know what a private space market will look like. You just had a presidential budget proposal come out from the Trump administration that said, we want to spend $200 million per year somehow seeding private industry and a commercial marketplace in low Earth orbit and orbiting the Earth. But that's all it really says. It doesn't exactly know what that means. And so these companies come on and develop, let's say, an orbiting space station. What is the market for that space station? We actually don't know that yet. We don't know what going to the moon with a commercial partner, what does that actually mean? Does that mean just the government just pays these companies and it's just a different type of contracting method? People talk about maybe there's some resources on the moon that you could mine and bring back to Earth. Well, that's possible, but you could probably mine those same resources on the Earth itself and for a lot cheaper and for a lot less work. So we're at this strange point where there's a lot of ambition and a lot of energy and excitement, but we still don't know what it's going to look like ultimately. We don't know where that market's going to be, and we don't know how lucrative even that market market's going to be. Viable commercial marketplace in space right now is for satellite communications. And that has been independent on its own for decades because you can sell bandwidth and other things, you know, for people like watching TV and having internet and other basic commodities of our modern life that we're used to now throughout the developing world. We need satellites for that. It's a real open question of where this is going. But the interesting thing is that you have this alignment between ambitions from companies and entrepreneurs and actually the government itself at this point.
Casey Dreyer, I want to thank you so much for taking time from your schedule to talk with us today.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
That was Casey Dreyer, the Director of Space Policy at the Planetary Society, headquartered in Pasadena, California. And that's all the time we have on this science edition of Press Conference USA. Thanks so much to all of you for listening, and thanks goes to our studio technician, Larry Pronko. This is Rick Pantaleo reminding you to join Carol Castiel next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.